Coming up on this week's book show, Karen Russell is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Vampires in the Lemon Grove and Swamplandia, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer. She now presents a new collection of short fiction that showcases her gifts of language and imagination called Orange World and Other Stories. Karen Russell on this week's book show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Karen Russell is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Vampires in the Lemon Grove and Swamplandia, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She now presents a new collection of short fiction that showcases her gifts of language and imagination. Orange World and Other Stories shows off Russell's talent for creating outlandish predicaments that uncannily mirror our inner lives. The collection features 8 stories, including Bog Girl, a story about first love, where a young man falls in love with a 2,000-year-old girl that he's extracted from a mass of peat in a northern European bog. In The Prospectors, two opportunistic young women fleeing the Depression strike out for new territory and find themselves fighting for their lives. In the hilarious title story, a new mother desperate to ensure her infant's safety strikes a diabolical deal, agreeing to breastfeed the devil in exchange for his protection. The name of the new book is Orange World and Other Stories. It is a great pleasure to welcome Karen Russell to this week's book show. Karen, thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Oh, Joe, I'm so excited to be back. It feels nice to have a new book in the world.
Give us a sense as to what point you realized your comfort level with the short story.
You know, I think it's a more natural fit for me in some ways than longer forms. For better or for worse, I feel pretty peripatetic imaginatively. I also have these weird counterfactuals, some of which you just beautifully described and paraphrased. So, you know, that experiment, the kind of what would happen if experiment, the story is uniquely suited to sort of a wild conceit, you know, or a fantastical premise where nobody might want to read a trilogy about, you know, a woman who breastfeeds the devil. That really does feel kind of in line with something the length of a fairy tale to me. And I think writers, it's interesting, like you sort of discover your natural length. These are very long stories for being short stories.
They are.
Maybe I want to have my cake and eat it too. You know, there's a way where then you can really build a world, and there's a kind of the roominess of a novella, but you also get to go deep on one question or one idea.
Swamplandia was a fairly long novel, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was super long.
How did that feel different in the sense of was there a freedom that came with that? I said, oh God, I can create this entire world and just keep going.
Right. I think one of my many naivetes, you know, moving from a short story to a novel, was that I had written this short story, Ava Russell's The Alligator, that novel was based on. And I think I just thought, this is great. I know the world. I know the characters. Like, you know, I'll be laughing all the way to the bank. Like, I really think I thought it was going to be a much easier birth. And I also thought that, you know, maybe a novel can be sort of endlessly digressive. And of course, you still need to have structure and momentum, you know. So it was a little bit of a learning process for me because I have these alternating storylines. And so to kind of get those to sync up in a way that felt satisfying was the real revision project for that book.
You are from Florida, and there is that Floridian weirdness that I think Carl Hiaasen has obviously put his finger on, that you take up in that, and it comes to light in these stories as well.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I did sort of find I was excited. A lot of the stories in this collection, they're set in landscapes that are quite foreign to me, you know. Whereas in earlier work, I really felt like most of my fictional life, I was just sort of putting down a stake in my childhood backyard in some ways.
Right.
And nevertheless, you know, there's that story you mentioned, The Prospectors, about these grifter girls who are get involved in the wrong kind of party during the Great Depression in the West. And I had such a hard time figuring out who these characters were. And it wasn't until I gave them a backstory in Florida, you know, that I sort of felt comfortable to launch into Oregon. And so it's just a funny thing. I mean, that is still probably my creative home in a lot of ways. And it is such a totally strange and wonderful place. I think it's so matter of fact about its strangeness that I wasn't even aware of it until I left that peninsula for college, you know?
Right. It's interesting because when you think of, oh, well, what kind of mom would strike a deal with the devil, you know, agreeing to breastfeed the devil in exchange for his protection? And then you think, oh, well, probably if we were to read that story, the woman may hail from Florida.
But you know, in that case, I mean, I might be delusional about this, but I strangely feel like so many of us would take that bargain, actually.
Well, sure.
But yeah, it does seem like the distance between something kind of ripped from the headlines. That was a real challenge about trying to write fiction in Florida, you know, is that then people would send me a news story. My dad, you know, trying to be helpful, my wonderful father would say, "Hey, look, children on a field trip, you know, fake archaeological dig, recover real body," and you know, stuff like that. So it's a little bit of a space race with reality if you're trying to imagine something interesting, you know, the real news might have you beat in Florida.
What brought you this is a journey in some ways. You coming out of school, you wrote a novel, it's successful, and then you end up in Portland, Oregon, and I guess you found a home, right? And so you seem to explore all of that conscious or unconsciously in the stories that you tell here.
Yeah, I think this book feels unique to me. It feels more coherent than some of the earlier collections in some ways, in part because all of the stories came out of this maybe 4 or 5 year window where I went from bouncing around like a grifter girl myself, you know, from various kind of visiting teaching gigs and residencies and stuff to really, I met my husband and we had our son and we moved into a home, which in paraphrase, this sounds like a very boring story, I realize, but it was astonishing to me. It was not something I actually was expecting for myself at all. And to find myself also shifted on the grid and like living in the shadow of the mountains was also a surprise. And so it was like at this time of real happiness for me and stability. And also then the world felt so much less stable and so much more uncertain. I mean, I don't have to tell you because we all lived it together, you
Right.
know. All of that kind of went into these stories, I think. Just the disorientation of trying to put down a root, you know, trying to make a home, and then also feeling kind of buffeted by extreme changes, you know, politically, in the climate, in like the very atmosphere, you know.
Karen Russell is our guest. The name of the new collection is Orange World and Other Stories. It is published by Knopf. The same question that I had for you in regards to Florida. What is happening in the world that it does seem to be that we take everything kind of in stride now. You can't, it's hard to surprise us in the sense of, oh, well, today they've decided they're just going to open up the cages of all the zoos, let the animals go. And you're like, oh, all right. And they did that today. Who knew? And is that difficult in the fiction writing of saying of what would be preposterous, what would be just imaginative and strange and outlandish predicament suddenly becomes very
Kind of
normalized.
banal. It's funny you mentioned that. You know, I'm traveling for this book, and I find that I just unconsciously brace myself after I get off a flight for, you know, whatever domino rally of horrors might come to me via my push notifications on the phone, you know, and it's exactly right. You sort of feels like nothing is out of bounds, you know, if they were like half the country sank into the sea. And I think it's also a little disorienting because everything, it feels sort of like a lateral slide between, you know, stories that have these truly apocalyptic implications. And then it'll be like, you know, get the most out of Cyber Monday. And it's all right recipes to try this weekend. I mean, really, you know, it'll be like, you know, it's horrifying to me a little bit, right? It'll be like migrant families tear gas on the border and then, you know, 5-minute bouillabaisse or whatever. And it's strange. It's strange to be alive and to feel the velocity at which things are changing, including the way that we're all, this accelerated connectivity too, where so much is impinging on your life kind of at every moment because of these devices. And this is like a very long-winded way of saying, I think more than ever before, the analog book feels like a sanctuary to me.
It does.
It feels like such a sanctuary to me. It's happening at a different speed, right? And it's a very different kind of intimacy and a different way of sort of processing and knowing about. And I think in fiction, the best surprises, you know, I often tell students this now because I've just found it to be true. Like, if you're not surprised as a writer, why would you ever expect your reader to be surprised by something that you made? So some of the surprises in this book, you know, I went into that this story about the ball girl, and I had this idea that I wanted to kind of give this story a sort of a feminist twist at the end. So I knew that going in sort of as its author. And maybe what surprised me was just this sort of seep of maternal anxiety that found its way into that story. You know, how important this mother character who I thought of as sort of ancillary became.
Right.
And so it's quieter sometimes, maybe, even in a story with a really, you know, that's sort of wearing its weirdness on its sleeve, you know. So still I feel the things that surprise me line to line are often these dimensions open up of these human people. The title story, I really had a hard time figuring out where that one was supposed to land. In a sort of oblique way, what opened things up for me, this particular mother who is a very bad negotiator and, you know, brokers not a great deal with the devil for the safety of her child. She just has these conversations with her own mother who is taking care of her grandmother in like a hospice center on the other side of the world. And this takes up so little story real estate. But for whatever reason, that became one of the most surprising elements of that story for me, was how essential that connection felt, you know, how important it felt to have this new mother's voice in there. And I don't know how it works for other writers, but I do sort of think, like, that's always interesting to me, that what I think is going to be the big dramatic turn or surprise isn't always where I think the emotional crux of the story comes in.
There is a line in that story that I circled. To me, it almost perfectly encapsulated, well, just how beautiful a writer you are, but also just how weird the world is. Whatever you do, Yvette says, don't read anything online. Those message board bitches are crazy. They'll tell you your baby is going to die and sign off with an angel emoji. Well, that's kind of it, isn't it? It's just a weirdness that all that stuff can come together.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, if there's no other takeaway for the listeners from this interview, I really stand by that advice. In my humble opinion, you don't want to go on message boards often. I'm sure that there are genuine communities forming somewhere, but I think I discovered that the hard way. You know, you go down some strange rabbit holes at 4 a.m. online. And
I mean, did that come out of an interest in reading either about your work, about your craft, that did bring you initially down some of those rabbit holes?
Well, that's also good advice that I've gotten recently, which is sort of to stay off some of those review sites.
Yeah.
And I just think writers' brains particularly, I mean, not to make a sweeping generalization, I just think the way that we freight criticism versus, you know, something positive, I could read 11 billion beautiful reviews and they sort of sieve right through me. And then if somebody, you know, Jojo Boy 49 is like, I cut this book up with scissors and set it on fire. And, you know, I've never hated anything more.
Yeah.
I find myself nodding. I'm like, Jojo Boy 49 has my number. That's, you know, so it's, I think it can be a little dangerous, right? Because you don't necessarily know what you're taking on board. And it's not really for you either. It's for readers. It's, you know, they're not writing that for you. especially right now, it's interesting because I sort of forgot. It's been a while since I've put a book into the world. And it's like such a strange ego trampoline to be on, you know? It's such a vulnerable and exposing kind of a weird feeling to turn it over to the crowds. I do think, you know, there's smart critics out there that you can learn from, certainly. You know, you want to be open to criticism, right? I mean, I think that is probably how people get better. But I tell students this because I sort of noticed there's this masochistic tendency where they'll be like, you don't have to tell me anything nice about my work, Karen. I just want to hear the ugly truth. And I sort of think, but you need to practice listening to what you're doing well too, right? That's how you echolocate. You're getting a lot of echoes back. So, and you want to figure out how to navigate your way into some future for this particular project. You know, find a way to do what you're doing better. And it is sort of important. You can't just throw out the more positive information. Do you know? I sort of think there's a tendency where people want to do that because it feels like, oh, you don't have to cushion the blow. And it's like, well, this isn't cushion. This is also information.
But I love what you're saying because I also teach. I think there is a feeling. I'm going to try this out on you as a theory. I've only been working on this for like a week. So let me give it to you and see what you think. It's the there's so much about this early on that kids are given. There's helicopter parents and there's participation trophies and kids are coddled. But then something happens when they go to college, when they go to school and they go away, where apparently all we're supposed to do is tell them that they're not ready for the real world. And what I find with students that if you do indeed tell them what they do right, they just seem shocked.
Yes.
They don't know how to react when you say, you did a fantastic job. This is beautiful what you just did.
Right, right. They look at you with deep suspicion, right?
Yes. And I think that's inherently sad. I they're so used to being kind of beat up that when you give them not a literal hug, but one of encouragement,
right,
they don't know what to do with it.
Right. There's no kind of way for them to metabolize that.
Right.
I mean, I say this for myself too, because hypocritically, I also find that it's so easy to kind of list in a dark direction. But yeah, I think that's part of what an MFA program did for me. And I know there's all kinds of opinions out there about their value. But, you know, one thing was that it introduced me to other writers who I felt like were part of my literary family tree. And then, you know, and it introduced me to peers who I just, you know, admired to the skies and who we were like this dolphin pod or something, you know, like everyone's kind of moving together. But it also, you start to learn what kind of creature you are on the page, right? And if the answer had only been at that time, I mean, I was so insecure. I think if my professors had been, if it had only been negative, I would have, like, listened to those Subway ads and, you know, become a massage therapist in 6 months or whatever. You know, like, I would have just found something else to do. So it was really valuable, actually, to have people sort of help you set your own compass and say, okay, this isn't, it's not working yet, right?
Right.
But here are some latent possibilities and here's what you seem to be arrowing towards. And this is like where the most energy is, you know, in what you're doing.
So back to echolocate, you had that freedom to kind of find your way, to find where it was that was your comfortable spot.
Yeah. And I think what was really also helpful about having these 14 very smart readers respond to, you know, some story that you put up, I just think you start to internalize those voices insofar as you start to get this sense of how readers are doing with the words you're putting on the paper. And I think the best writers, right, I don't know how they would figure out what they've made without those echoes back. You know, and I really, it is such a nerdy metaphor, but that really was what it felt like to me, you know, where you're kind of flying in the dark, crashing around. And then if 14 people, you know, are telling you, hey, we really don't know why this Minotaur is, you know, like how, you know, that just one for one very personal,
yes,
specific example, right? Like, why is this Minotaur playing baseball in your story about the American West or whatever, you know, but also just sort of getting some kind of insight into what people are really interested in, which maybe doesn't always line up with your idea of what the story wants to become, right? Getting some idea like, oh, this, here's something that maybe I'm even sort of shy about pursuing, right? Or, I mean, I feel like that can happen too. And then it's nice to have people say, no, like, as uncomfortable as this makes you, it seems like this piece wants to go in this direction. I have a friend who teaches, and I just love this expression. He says, as readers, we're so hungry for conflict and drama and tension. And then sometimes as writers, in this kind of self-defeating way, he calls it looking away to the foliage, you know, no sooner does something really interesting start to open up or something really dark, you know, is starting to happen, then you jump into the bushes, you know, and have like three paragraphs of lyrical description or something.
Karen Russell is our guest. The name of the new book is Orange World. The thing I love about these stories, and as I started to read each one, is you didn't know where you were going to be. You could be in the 1620s. You could be in current day. You could be in the Depression era. This person could be this. This person could be that. You don't know. You have to figure it out. There was a puzzle there that had to be put together rather quickly as you find your way through the story. And I was thinking of, in reading that, how much fun that is. And then I wondered what, if that, and I know that fun is never a word that should be ascribed to the process of writing, but to work your way, I mean, you mentioned this a little bit when you were talking about writing Orange World, the story itself, of being in a bind of, okay, well, where is this going to end up?
Right.
That it is a puzzle, isn't it? And I assume that's where the great joy comes, and when you do figure it out.
That's where the great joy comes. Absolutely. And it's so funny. I feel like that should be a bumper sticker all writers get. I had a friend who said, our fun is not everybody's fun. And I was like, amen, man, because our fun is only fun like a fraction of the time, right? And or I speak for myself. But yeah, I sort of think that I've heard George Saunders describe it as kind of the dance between the subconscious and the conscious mind, that kind of wrestling match where, you know, you can sort of you get stuck in some cul-de-sac and you're not really sure and you're kind of beating your head against some problem. And then there is a little bit of a solution or some surprise that opens up and you can move forward in a draft again. And I think the stories that I love best are the ones that look the least like my original idea of what they're going to be. The Prospectors, strangely the surprise there. I mean, I had this idea. That story was a little bit of joy to write because it's bounded in this way. I was like, this is great. They're going to go up a mountain. I thought, okay, this actual geologic structure is going to undergird the action, you know, a little bit. And that felt wonderful, right? I felt like I went into it and I could riff and play a little bit because I had this sort of natural structure, like the bones of it in my mind. It just developed some different kinds of resonances that I wasn't totally expecting. And the nature of the threat changed on me a little bit.
And yet in all of the stories, the apocalyptic is sort of just bubbling underneath, just waiting, right?
Yeah, I liked calling this collection Orange World. That's just a kind of the awning that I feel like all the stories exist under. A couple of people have asked me about the connection to this current administration.
Well, sure.
And I will say, I mean, our president, he already thinks everything is about him. This book is in no way an explicit reference.
You keep this for yourself, Karen.
Yeah, this is mine. I even feel like Swamplandia as a title has sort of been poisoned by, and it makes me mad, you know? I read a wonderful op-ed that I loved. It was this poet who was saying, you know, we've already destroyed half the wetlands in this country. Wetlands are a beautiful ecosystem, you know, vital to life on this planet. We have to stop this draining the swamp metaphor. You know, she was like really upset on the swamp's behalf. She's like, swamps are not fetid corruption, which I appreciated.
Let a swamp be a swamp.
Yeah, exactly. But all to say, I went to this, you know, I did take this sort of anxious new mom class, like a safety class when I was pregnant with our son. And this educator really made it seem sort of inevitable that he was going to die some gruesome death in a household accident. I mean, I can't even describe to you the tenor of this. It was, I mean, we really had to rehearse the darkest possibilities, you know, in like a pleasantly lit room. And she said, you know, green world is the ideal. It's this world of infinite attention and safety. And then you have red world, which like in this iteration was just a true kind of hellscape. She's like, Orange World is where most of us live. You know, we're a little bit distracted. You know, we're not fully present. to the precariousness of the of our lives. We're kind of half awake, basically. And I was like, that is really true, isn't it? And I thought about all these stories existing in that kind of limbo, right? Where these a lot of these characters are angling, right? They're dreamers, like these two girls in The Prospectors, or there's a honeymooning couple that goes to Joshua Tree, or this doctor in the 1620s, as you mentioned, who has kind of a beautiful dream for his life.
Right.
And so you can feel like a green world humming inside them, I hope. And then it's just a short commute sort of into something that feels, as you said, apocalyptic.
Which is different than a pessimism, isn't it?
I hope so. I hope so. I think it's scarier, right? It's sort of scarier to be alive to all the ways a story can go. This is going to sound like a weird digression, but indeed, I did go to Joshua Tree National Park. And don't do this, you guys. We used the GPS, and it said we were headed towards something called College Road. Before you knew it, like, our Prius was really stuck in the sand. And do you know that feeling where you can sort of feel like the shadow growing alongside you in parallel? I mean, we were still telling jokes, you know. We're trying to, like, dig the car out. But there was really no one around. It was probably 100 degrees. And you can sort of feel like this story could go any number of ways, you know. We could be home tonight in the motel laughing about it, right? Or like, you sort of also, you try to sort of keep your eye on the road and not see on the periphery your future obituary. You know, like, it feels like it really, obviously we can't live our lives in a state of kind of eternal vigilance, but sort of, I mean, this is a stupider example, but, you know, remember those Looney Tunes cartoons where, like, Wile E. Coyote was suspended over the abyss?
Yeah. So it seems as though it is inevitable that I have to ask this question, so I will, and then I'll get it over with, which is, are you at work on a novel? Is that something you're interested in doing again? Are you?
It's so funny with books that take a long time, right? It's sort of like, I've noticed this, you pass a certain threshold, and it's almost as if it's like you have a goiter nobody wants to inquire about, you know? You're like, is it still growing, or has it relinquished its hold on you? The goiter, you know, it becomes
you having this removed.
Like,
what are you doing?
Yeah, this really private, like, and almost like this is it's taboo to even talk about it. It is my great dream to publish a second novel. I would love nothing more. Inconveniently, I guess, you know, the world has changed. I feel so profoundly since I began this project, and so have I. And I had this kind of disorienting experience. I don't know if other people have had this. You know, I opened up the draft after my son was born, and really I was like, oh my gosh, what lunatic thought this was interesting, you know? I had to sort of like shimmy my way in through another window. It felt like I locked myself out of my house, and I had to just find a way to jigger the door, get in from another, if that's a crazy metaphor, I realize, with no context whatsoever. But I did sort of feel like, okay, well, the challenge now, I still love this world and I love these characters, but I'm not sure how to inhabit them again. I've been away for a while. So that's sort of where I find myself right now.
Well, in the meantime, there is this beautiful collection. It is called Orange World and Other Stories. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program Book Markets for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.